Another Voice, Fire on the Hills by Robinson Jeffers. The deer were bounding like blown leaves under the smoke in front of the roaring wave of the brush fire. I thought of the smaller lives that were caught. Beauty is not always lovely. The fire was beautiful, the terror of the deer was beautiful, and when I returned down the back slopes after the fire had gone by, an eagle was perched on the jag of a burnt pine. Insolent and gorged, cloaked in the folded storms of his shoulders, he had come from far off for the good hunting. With the fire for his beater to drive the game, the sky was merciless, blue, and the hills merciless black. The somber-feathered great bird, sleepily merciless between them, I thought painfully, but the whole mind, the destruction that brings an eagle from heaven is better than mercy.
I was haunted by that poem by Robinson Jeffers. I read it again and again. I took that one line as the title of the sermon, Beauty is Not Always Lovely. We think about earth and we can romanticize it, but it is also red in tooth and claw. And the things that are destructive for one can end up being creative for another. According to the Christian Church's liturgical calendar, we are in the season of Easter. Now, the Sundays following Easter until Pentecost are this Easter season, and they reflect the metaphor of resurrection. And this past Friday was also Earth Day and kind of celebrated as Earth Weekend. So if Easter is a season and not just a day, maybe Earth Day can be a season and not just a day. What if we weave the Easter season and the Earth season? Why not? The central symbol for Christianity is the resurrection of Jesus. And Christians have a wide variety of views about this story. Some regard it as a literal event. Others regard it as a parable or as a symbol or as a metaphor. For some, the important action on our end is to believe it, to believe that it's true, that it happened, Jesus rising from the dead. For other Christians, belief is not as important. For those Christians who regard it as a symbol or a metaphor, the resurrection of Jesus is about something else altogether. Not necessarily about something one believes, it's something in which one participates. Peter Rollins is a Christian theologian, and he speaks provocatively to make a point. And this is what he said about resurrection. Without equivocation or hesitation, I fully and completely admit that I deny the resurrection of Christ. This is something that anyone who knows me could tell you, and I'm not afraid to say it publicly, no matter what some people may think. I deny the resurrection of Christ every time I do not serve at the feet of the oppressed, each day that I turn my back on the poor. I deny the resurrection of Christ when I close my ears to the cries of the downtrodden and lend my support to an unjust and corrupt system. However, there are moments when I affirm that resurrection, few and far between as they are. I affirm it when I stand up for those who are forced to live on their knees, when I speak for those who have had their tongues torn out, when I cry for those who have no more tears left to shed. Here the importance is not placed on what a person believes or doesn't believe about what might have happened to the person Jesus. The importance is on how one participates in the possibility that this parable of resurrection invites. Resurrection invites us, regardless of what we think about it, but it does invite us into the possibility of new life. Not only an invitation, but it's a call, a summons, to die to an old way of living and to be born to a new way of living. Now, this is not merely a one-time event, but an ongoing spiritual struggle. We are all being called, lured, summoned, invited to live into the resurrection. A way of living that is truthful, that is honest, that is beautiful, that is just, that is compassionate, that is life-giving for ourselves and for our neighbors and for all creatures, all living things. And I'm using Christian language here, but the practice, the spiritual struggle are similar among all of our different faith traditions. This weekend, I was asked to speak at Bilal Masjid. It's the mosque in Beaverton. The theme of the conference was Tikkun Olam, which is the Hebrew phrase that means repair the world. What does that phrase mean from our different faith perspectives? That was the question put to us. And I joined some other speakers, one speaking from the perspective of Islam, one speaking from the perspective of Judaism, and I myself from the perspective of Christianity. And there was another set of speakers, a family of four, who spoke from a faith-neutral position. And they were rather inspiring. The four of them got up and they asked, what if? That was the question. What if? Good to ask those questions. What if? What if we sold and gave away our stuff and traveled around the world, not knowing where we would stay from one day to the next? And then they said, why not? And so they did that, this family, just kind of going, and they found it cost them $137 a day just to go tour the world, not knowing from one place to stay. But it was kind of, they're kind of a courageous bunch, and they do it all kinds of different kinds of things, and they would ask it in terms of inspiring people to be courageous. What if? Why not? And they invited the group of us to ask two questions. What if, and why not? Rather than say, you should, or we should, say, what if? And then, well, why not? What if I decided to start my own business? Why not? What if we decided to house the homeless? Why not? So as I was preparing my presentation for the mosque, as well as for our gathering here on Friday night, when we invited the other mosque, our friends across the street, to join us for a meal and a celebration of Earth Day, I thought of this phrase, tikkun olam, repair the world, was certainly fitting for Earth Day and for Christianity's central symbol of resurrection. And I also thought it might even fit with the concept of jihad in Islam. Extremists within Islam and those outside of Islam who wish to discredit it, who do not understand the word jihad, think that it's about violence. But it's primarily and most importantly about a spiritual struggle. It's about striving, persevering, applying oneself to that which is good. In fact, to the highest good. Repairing the world, dying to an old way of living, being resurrected to a new way of living, participating in the struggle for the good, all echo one another. Tikkun olam, jihad, rising with Christ, all are religion-specific terms for something that I think is universal. And that is to participate with our whole being in a life of healing and compassion and renewal of self, of society, and of earth itself. So whether we're Muslim, Christian, Jew, secular, the call, the summons, the invitation is the same, to repair the world, to live with kindness, self-sacrifice, compassion, truthfulness, joy. And this involves a conscious, ongoing change from an old way of living to a new way of living, the life of faith. That's the theological part. But theology can never remain just abstract. It must risk. It must dare to be specific, even as it, in so doing, it will be distorted. But it must do it anyway. It must dare to be specific. It must enter the fray and inconsistency and confusion of life and address it. On one hand, humility, knowing that it's we see in a mirror darkly, but on the other hand, courageously. So what if we took the risk and applied our theology, our faith, to real-life situations? Why not? So, with this thread of resurrection, let's weave in another thread, Earth Day. And for this, I needed for the sermons to turn to the poets, like Robinson Jeffers. In his poem, Fire on the Hills, Jeffers captures the painful reality of loss and destruction. A wildfire burns and destroys a forest, driving out the animals, but it's in the fire itself that brings the eagle out of heaven to gorge itself on the good hunting that the fire leaves. Good or bad? How do you decide? Is nature merciful? No. Jeffers concludes the poem, however, with the haunting line, "The destruction that brings an eagle from heaven is better than mercy." And yet, he says, painfully, painfully. It is what it is. In the book of Job, we hear the character God speak from the whirlwind, chiding Job. Are you so smart, Job? Is it by your wisdom that the hawk soars? Is it by your command that the eagle mounts up, makes its nest, spies the prey? No, of course not. We are thrust into life, into nature. We are nature. We seek vainly for meaning and direction like a blind, newly hatched eaglet seeks the slain prey its mother brings to it. And then finally, the Odes of Solomon. Recently discovered texts, recently being a century ago, but recently in the terms of we didn't have it in our Bible or anything. We didn't know about it, these texts. But they were early Christian texts, apparently from the Christians that didn't make the team. But it's a beautiful text, beautiful poetry. How do we live under the merciless sky where we know far less than what we think we know? There's no difficult path where the heart is simple, writes the poet. Trust and live and be saved. Trust and live. So I want to include this poetry that reflects on, in essence, the powerlessness of humans. Because it's true on one hand. We must trust and live, accept that we do not have the answers, painfully admit, in the words of Jeffers, the destruction that brings the eagle from heaven is better than mercy. And in that reality, trust and live. I don't know what an evolutionary biologist would think, but I wonder if the human being survived in part because of its hubris. We have manipulated our environment to the extent that we sometimes think that we can answer affirmatively God's rhetorical questions. Are you wise enough? Do you have the command for the eagle and the hawk? Yes, it is by our wisdom and command that the eagle and the hawk fly. We even have small sanctuaries for them. We human beings have done incredible things, amazing things, merciful things. You know the song Billy Joel, "We Didn't Start the Fire"? Well, we didn't start the fire, but we did find creative ways to keep it burning. And now we have some choices to make. In her 1962 book, Rachel Carson, the book was called Silent Spring, she opened our awareness to the poisons that we were unleashing into the world at that time. Stuff that we needed to kill the bugs, realizing that those had far-reaching consequences more than we thought. Think of all the chemicals that we unleashed back then, DDT. We were playing with fire, threatening all of life, and she offered her own summons for a new path. She said, "We stand now where two roads diverge. But unlike the roads in Robert Frost's familiar poem, they are not equally fair. The road we've long been traveling is deceptively easy, a smooth superhighway on which we progress with great speed, but at its end lies disaster, the other fork of the road. The one less traveled by offers our last, our only chance to reach a destination that assures the preservation of the earth." Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, 1962. In 2016, we are perilously closer to disaster than we were in 1962. In addition to pesticides and chemicals, we have a more ominous danger. The scientific consensus, and consensus means that's really not an argument, the scientific consensus, there is no argument among 99% of scientists, is that the planet is warming, and it is warming because of increasing levels of CO2 in the atmosphere that have been put there from the burning of fossil fuels. What scientists don't know exactly is which model the prediction will yield, what devastating effects of global warming will be for us and our grandchildren and when. And yet, every time I see the news, it seems that every report that we hear, the effects are larger and faster than the previous report. We are seeing now climate disruptions of extreme heat, extreme drought, extreme cold, extreme flooding that are caused by the warming of Earth due to human activity. My first year in Portland, last year, I moved here January 1, 2015. You might want to start right on day one. And in my first year, I was told by the natives and had it confirmed by weather reports that the summer was the driest and the hottest and that December was the wettest than anyone had remembered just this last year. Global warming doesn't mean that the climate is always warm, of course, despite Rush Limbaugh. The temperature of Earth as a whole, on an average, is increasing. The planet is warming. The effects of this warming are climate disruptions. that we have been experiencing and likely will continue to experience at more intense levels, including colder air weather in some points, more storms, more action like that. So you might ask me, well, preacher, why is this a religious problem? Well, I think it is a religious problem, a spiritual problem. In fact, I think it's perhaps one of the most important, if not the most important, spiritual problem. It's a human problem because the warming is caused by human beings, and it certainly will affect human beings. We are not outside of nature watching. We are it. And it's also a spiritual problem because human beings are a little bit lackadaisical in facing this. You know, and that's why there's religion in the first place. Its role, its assignment, its job, its summons is to hear the call and to respond. We are endangering ourselves and the very possibility of life for children and grandchildren. What if we used all the language, all the metaphors, all the spiritual resources at our disposal to be the prophets and say it's time to die to an old way of living and be reborn, resurrected to a new way of living, to engage in a holy jihad, a struggle for the good, to engage in tikkun olam, the repair of the world, to participate in resurrection? What if? Why not? Now, earth is not merciful in the way we might delude ourselves into thinking it might be. It doesn't really care about us. But it won't just take what we hurl at it and sit silently. Actions have consequences, and ultimately, humans must adapt to earth, not earth to humans. We adapt, that is, if we're lucky. It's difficult to get a handle on what effects our fossil fuel consumption will be. We hear things like the glaciers melting, the sea level is going to rise so many inches by the year 2100. But that's fairly abstract. It's hard to get emotional about. Also in the distance, we don't know quite what that means. But what if we became storytellers to describe in explicit terms what this means, what our choices are, and what the results of these choices might be? This past summer in Portland, we knew what it was like when it's 100 degrees. What will it be like when it's 120 degrees? Those are some of the extreme temperatures that many places in the United States are now hitting that hadn't hit before. We're talking about places not just hot, but uninhabitable. If our spiritual prophets were anything, they were storytellers, not telling fables, but creating word pictures to highlight our situation. It's a spiritual problem because I think it will take a spiritual repentance, renewal, conversion to change the path and to take the road less traveled by, in the words of Rachel Carson. And there are forces that do not want this truth to be told. They will say that global warming is a hoax, that climate change is an invention, that the scientists really don't know, that it isn't true that the earth is warming due to fossil fuel extraction and fossil fuel burning, that there's really nothing we could do about it even if it was. And that's why this is a spiritual problem. It's a spiritual problem because not only are we facing the problem of global warming itself, but we are facing a denial, in fact, an active campaign to silence the science. What if, as spiritual people, we called out falsehood and deception? That's a spiritual task. That's the task of tikkun olam, the task of repairing the world. David Ray Griffin, a theologian, has written an important book called Unprecedented. Wonderful book, and powerful book, clear book about our situation and some possibilities. He lays out the problem very clearly. He says there are three plans available to us. Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C. Might call them paths, since we're kind of into the spiritual path thing. Path A, Path B, Path C. Dr. James Hansen, one of the most respected climatologists in the world, said, "If humanity wishes to preserve a planet similar to that on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, paleoclimate evidence and ongoing climate change suggest that CO2 will need to be reduced from current levels to at most 350 parts per million, We are now at over 400 parts per million and rising. All right. Well, let's start with Plan B. Plan or Path B is a radical mobilization on a global scale to reduce carbon emissions so that we reduce the amount of carbon in the atmosphere down to safe levels, 350. It has to be done immediately. It has to be done severely. Wednesday. We need to do this Wednesday. The result, if we do this, heat waves will continue. Heat waves will increase. Climate disruptions will increase, but at least we'll survive. It won't be intolerable. That's the best course of action if we take it now. Plan A is the plan we're on, business as usual, continuing without a significant change in policy. This could lead to warming of an average of 10 to 11 degrees Fahrenheit in the United States by 2090. Again, that sounds abstract, but remember 10 to 11 degrees in one country on an average. We're talking temperatures of 120 in Portland. These future temperatures would exceed livable temperatures. Griffin says half the world's population would be in an uninhabitable environment, meaning that 5 billion people would either die or move to places that are still habitable. That's Plan A. That's the one we're doing. Plan C is on the table. Let's wait and see. This plan says let's wait for another 20 years and see how bad it gets. If the temperature rises 3 or 4 degrees centigrade, then we'll mobilize. Well, the problem, of course, is that we are paying now the debts for the CO2 levels that we released into the atmosphere for decades. Extreme weather conditions, including heat waves, will likely to continue to become unbearable for more and more people. The carbon continue to rise. In other words, it won't practically be any different than Plan A, business as usual. So David Ray Griffin writes with the words of a prophet, "The wait and see approach will likely condemn our children and grandchildren, beginning as early as the 2060s, to a hellish existence. They might begin to wonder, in fact, how their summers differ from the weather in the popular image of hell." Griffin writes, and I'm paraphrasing, "What if we responded to global warming like the great generation responded to Adolf Hitler? What if we mobilized, not only as a country, but as a planet, and said the most important thing we can do right now is reduce the carbon emissions to safe levels? What would it take to get us down to 350? What if we engaged in a World War II-like mobilization on a global scale to reduce CO2 to 350 parts per million? You know, if there were a meteor coming, and they could figure that out, you know, like it's going to come in like 10 years and it's going to get us, we'd mobilize for that. We would have every scientist, every conversation would be about how we could blast that guy so it heads over to Pluto or something. That's what we would do. But we don't have quite that passion for this. We haven't quite developed the seriousness of this yet. But what if we, you, me, as individuals, didn't wait for the government or someone else to take the lead? What if, in our own way, we began right now? Why not? What if we educated ourselves, really, about the problem? I'm not talking about listening to the nutcases, but listening to the real scientists who are telling us again and again, very clearly, what we're facing. What if we educated ourselves? What if we took the most powerful symbol of our faith tradition, resurrection, and applied it to earth care, to our home? What if we decided to die to an old way of living and be born, resurrected into a new way of being? What if we decided not to just get bummed out about it and depressed and fatalistic, but saw it as an opportunity? This is it. This is our task. This is our opportunity to be respected ancestors by future generations, because that's how we'll be evaluated. Our descendants, our children, our grandchildren will look back and say, "What? They did Plan C? What if? What if we didn't do this in a depressed way, but just said we're going to do this in an active way, in a joyful way, in a joyful experience of resurrection that we have nothing to lose, Because we don't, except if we don't, earth itself. What if we acted? What if? Why not? Amen.